All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're looking at a case, a landmark case, I think we can call it that.
I think so, yeah.
Gormley v. Robertson. And it's all about fairness, you know, fairness for unmarried couples and especially how it really impacted the LGBTQ plus community.
Yeah, and I mean, think about it. This case really, like, forced the legal system to catch up with how people actually live their lives, right? Like,
yeah.
Commitment and sharing a life doesn't always mean you have a marriage certificate to prove it.
Exactly. And that's, I think, what makes it so interesting for our listeners who are mostly law students is seeing that evolution. You know, it's like the law is finally saying, okay, fairness doesn't depend on your gender or whether you even had the option to get married at the time.
Right. It's about recognizing the relationship itself, right? Mm-hmm. And the contributions that both people made.
Absolutely. So what we're going to do in this deep dive is really understand why this legal idea was originally used for straight couples who couldn't legally marry, right?
Yeah.
But it became like super important for same-sex couples who were facing like those same legal roadblocks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, we'll get into the specifics of this case, of course, but I think it's helpful to think about it in this bigger context of fairness and property division, you
yeah.
know? Like, when a relationship ends, how do we make sure things are split fairly, regardless of whether there was a marriage involved?
Okay, so let's set the scene a bit. We've got Lynn Gormley and Julia Robertson. They're both both lieutenant commanders in the Navy. They were together for a decade.
10 years, yeah.
They've built a life together. You know, they had joint finances, and they even bought a house together in Yakima.
And this is where things get, you know, legally complicated, right?
Yeah.
Because the title to the house was only in Robertson's name. So when they split up, it really raised these questions about, well, you know, who has a right to what?
Exactly.
Like, what's fair here?
Yeah. So that gets to the heart of this case. And for you listening, it's this thing called the meretricious relationship doctrine. It's a mouthful, right? Sometimes it's called the committed intimate relationship doctrine now.
Right, right.
And the big question is, did it even apply to a same-sex couple back then? And then if it did, was the trial court's decision about, you know, splitting up the property, was that fair? Like, especially that house in Yakima?
Yeah, so much to unpack there.
Yeah, so let's rewind a bit. You know, Lynn and Julia, serving in the Navy, partners for 10 years. I mean, that's a significant chunk of time to build a life together.
It is. And they did,
yeah.
You know, they lived together. And like you said, their finances were really intertwined. They had this joint bank account and they used it for all their regular monthly expenses.
Like rent, groceries, all that.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, that pooling of resources, that's really important. We'll come back to that later when we talk about how the court actually looked at their relationship.
Right, right. And then there's the house, right? The house in Yakima, that's the big one. The thing that you really want to pay attention to here is that even though both women were contributing financially through that joint account, the legal title to the house, it only had Robertson's name on it.
Yeah. And that's really where the legal battle started, right?
It is.
Because when the relationship ended, Gormley, you know, she wanted a fair share of what they built together. It's totally understandable. And so initially she made her arguments based on these legal concepts like constructive trust and implied contract.
Like she was saying, look, even though my name's not on the paperwork, I was contributing, so I have an interest in this property.
Exactly, yeah. And it was actually, you know, her bringing up those arguments that led the trial court to consider applying the meretricious relationship doctrine in the first place.
So the trial court was kind of like, okay, this doctrine might actually fit here.
Right, exactly.
Interesting. Okay, so what did the trial court decide?
Well, the trial court actually ruled in Gormley's favor. Like, they really tried to make things fair. They awarded her 30% of the equity in the house.
Wow. Okay.
And they also, you know, they recognized that joint funds had been used to buy other things, personal property that Robertson ended up keeping. So they ordered Robertson to basically pay Gormley for her share of that stuff, too.
So at that point, things are looking good for Gormley.
Yeah, it was a pretty big win for her at that stage.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a legal case. It's not over yet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of course not. It's never that simple. What happened?
Well, Robertson, she wasn't happy with the decision.
It makes sense.
So she appealed. And that brought the whole case up to the appellate court.
Okay, so now we've got the appellate court involved. For our listeners, you know, what were the key things that they had to decide? Like, what were the big questions that the appellate court was grappling with?
So there were two main questions that the appellate court really had to focus on. First, Was the trial court even right to apply this committed intimate relationship doctrine to a same-sex couple in the first place?
Yeah.
Remember, this is back in 2004, and the doctrine had mostly been used for unmarried straight couples. So it was a big deal for the court to decide, okay, does this apply to same-sex relationships too?
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, the legal landscape back then was very different. Okay, so that was the first big question. What about the second?
The second question was all about the actual division of property and debts. Was it fair? You know, was that 30% equity award for the house the right amount?
Mm.
And there was also this issue with a loan that Gormley had gotten from her father. Robertson argued that, you know, the court shouldn't have even considered that debt, or that it was like too late to bring it up legally.
Oh, interesting. So we've got property, we've got debt. This is getting complex.
Yeah, it really highlights the kinds of issues that can come up when unmarried couples separate, you know, and there's no clear-cut legal framework in place.
All right. Well, let's hear what the appellate court had to say. What did Judge Cato say in the majority opinion?
Well, Judge Cato and the majority were very clear. They said, yes, the committed intimate relationship doctrine absolutely applies to same-sex couples. And their reasoning was really focused on what actually defines a relationship under this doctrine.
So what is that defining characteristic? What makes a relationship fall under this doctrine?
It all comes down to whether the partners knew that they couldn't legally get married. So, you know, for Lynn and Julia, back in 2004, same-sex marriage was not legal in Washington State. So that key element of the doctrine, the inability to legally marry it, was there.
So it's not about who the couple is. It's about the legal restrictions they were facing.
Right, exactly. And the court actually said, and this is really important, they said, the focus is on the nature of the relationship, not the gender of the parties.
Wow.
That's pretty powerful.
It is. It really shows that the court was trying to apply this doctrine in a more inclusive way. They weren't going to let, like, outdated ideas about marriage define what fairness meant.
Yeah. Okay, so they made that clear.
Yeah.
Now, what was the driving force behind that decision? Like, what principle were they really emphasizing?
It all comes down to making sure that the division of property is just inequitable, right? Like, we want to make sure that one partner doesn't benefit unfairly from the other partner's contributions just because, you know, they weren't married. That's what we call unjust enrichment. And this doctrine is a way to prevent that.
Exactly.
Now, I know that Chief Justice Brown, he had a slightly different opinion on this, right? He wrote a concurring opinion. What was his take?
So Chief Justice Brown, he actually agreed with the outcome of the case. He thought the way the trial court divided the property was fair. But he had a different way of thinking about the whole meretricious relationship doctrine itself.
So same conclusion, different reasoning.
Exactly. He argued that this case, maybe it should have been resolved as just a general property dispute, you know, without using this specific quasi-marital doctrine.
He wasn't, like, completely against the doctrine, was he?
No, no. But he was a little hesitant about applying it to same-sex couples in this way.
It sounds like he might have been concerned about kind of blurring the lines between what is marriage and what is a committed relationship, but not a marriage.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fair reading of his opinion. He seemed to think that the existing legal tools for dealing with property disputes and unjust enrichment, they were enough to handle this case.
Okay, so we've got the majority opinion setting a precedent, and then this concurring opinion raising some interesting points.
Right. It's good to see the court really wrestling with these complex issues.
It is. Now, before we get too far, you mentioned a five-factor test earlier. I think our listeners would benefit from hearing a little bit more about that. Like, what is it, and how did the court use it in this case?
Okay, so this five-factor test, it's basically what the courts use to figure out if a couple actually was in a meretricious relationship. It's like a checklist.
A checklist for commitment.
In a way, yeah. Uh-huh. So the factors are, did they live together continuously? How long were they together? What was the purpose of their relationship? Did they pool their resources for joint projects? Mm-hmm. And what was their intent? Like, what do they want their relationship to be?
So it's not just about, oh, they were together for a long time. It's really about, did they build a life together?
Right, exactly. Were they interdependent? Did they act like a married couple in terms of their finances and their responsibilities?
Got it. Okay. And if the court says, yes, this is a meretricious relationship, what happens then?
Well, then the court basically applies this idea that's similar to community property in a marriage. So they assume that anything the couple acquired during the relationship is owned equally by both partners. And then they try to divide things up fairly.
So it's like they're recognizing that even though they weren't legally married, they still created this partnership, this shared life.
Right. And the law needs to account for that.
Makes sense. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about these legal concepts, you know, for our law student listeners. The meretricious relationship doctrine itself, it has a pretty interesting history, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It actually started out being used in cases involving straight couples who were in relationships that were, well, kind of scandalous at the time.
Right.
You know, maybe one or both of them were already married to someone else.
Like affairs and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But even in those situations, the court started to recognize that, hey, if they acquired property together, we need to divide it fairly when they split up. Mm. And over time, that idea, it just broadened to include all kinds of committed relationships where couples weren't married, maybe because they couldn't be, like in Gormley.
So it's really about fairness in these relationships, regardless of, you know, what society thought of them at the time.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that commitment and shared lives can exist outside of marriage.
And like Judge Cato said, the key element is that the partners knew they couldn't legally marry.
Right. That's what separates these relationships from legal marriages in the eyes of the law, at least when we're talking about dividing property.
Okay. And you mentioned unjust enrichment earlier. Can you break that down for our listeners a little bit more? Like, how does that principle tie into all of this?
So unjust enrichment is basically the idea that one person shouldn't get to keep stuff that they acquired thanks to the other person's hard work, you know, without contributing themselves. And the committed intimate relationship doctrine is basically a tool to prevent that from happening when a relationship ends and there's no, you know, marriage contract to dictate how to split things up.
Just like you and I work together on a project, but I get all the credit and all the reward. That would be unjust enrichment.
Exactly. Yeah. And the law tries to prevent that from happening in these kinds of relationships.
Makes sense. Okay. And what are like the specific things the court can do to make sure things are fair?
Well, they have a few tools in their legal toolbox. They can use something called a constructive trust, where, you know, legally one person owns something, but the court says, actually, the other person has an interest in it, too. Or they can put an equitable lien on property to, you know, make sure one person gets their fair share if it's sold.
So it's not just about splitting things 50-50. It's about being flexible and making sure the outcome is truly equitable.
Right. It has to be tailored to the specific circumstances of the relationship.
All right. So back to Gormley. The fact that the court applied this doctrine in a gender-neutral way, that was a pretty big deal, right? Especially back in 2004.
It was huge. I mean, think about it. Washington State didn't even recognize same-sex marriage at the time.
Mm.
So Lynn and Julia, they couldn't get married, even if they wanted to. So the court saying, hey, this doctrine applies to you too, that was a really important step forward. It was the court saying, we're going to try to be fair to same-sex couples, even if the law hasn't caught up yet.
Yeah. It's like they were acknowledging the reality of people's lives, you know, even if the law wasn't quite there yet.
Right. And it shows that the courts can sometimes be more progressive than the legislature, you know?
Yeah.
They can be more willing to adapt to social change.
That's an important point for law students to remember. Okay. And I want to circle back to Chief Justice Brown's concurring opinion for a second. You know, he was kind of critiquing the use of this specific doctrine. I think that raises some interesting questions about the law in general, doesn't it? Like, when do we use specific doctrines and when do we just rely on these broader ideas of fairness?
I think that's a tension that exists throughout the law, right? On the one hand, you want clear rules, you want predictability. That's what doctrines like this one provide. But on the other hand, you also want flexibility. You want the courts to be able to consider the unique circumstances of each case and come to a truly just outcome.
So it's like, do we stick to the letter of the law or do we go with the spirit of the law?
Exactly. And in this case, Chief Justice Brown was basically saying, maybe we don't need this specific doctrine to achieve fairness here. Maybe the general principles of equity are enough.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? Like, should the label we put on a relationship determine how we divide property? Or should we just focus on, you know, who contributed what and what's fair, given the specific circumstances?
It's a really interesting question. And I think it's one that the courts are still grappling with today, you know, especially as we see more and more diverse family structures.
Absolutely. Okay. Let's get back to the specifics of Gormley for a minute. Why did the appellate court agree with that 30% equity award for Gormley? Like, what was their reasoning there?
Well, they looked at all the evidence, and they saw that both women had contributed to the mortgage payments, and they had both put money from their joint account towards improvements on the house. So that 30% award, it was really just a reflection of Gormley's financial contributions over the years.
So it was about making sure Robertson didn't benefit unfairly from those joint investments.
Right.
Okay. And what about that lien on the property? What was that all about?
So the lien, it was basically a way to make sure that Gormley actually got her share of the equity if Robertson ever decided to sell the house. It protected her financial interest.
It prevented Robertson from just running off with all the money.
Right.
Okay, so that makes sense. Now, what about that debt to Gormley's father? That seemed to be a bit of a sticking point.
It was. Robertson argued that, you know, too much time had passed for Gormley to be able to legally claim anything related to that loan. But Gormley, she was able to show the court that they were still making payments on that loan and that at least one of those payments had been made from their joint account pretty recently.
So the court was like, okay, this is still an active part of their financial relationship.
Right. They didn't see it as some, you know, ancient debt that was no longer relevant.
That shows you how important it is to keep good records, right?
Absolutely. Especially when you're in a committed relationship where you're sharing finances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always good advice. All right. So after all of this, what's the big takeaway from Gormley v. Robertson? Like, what rule of law did it establish?
The main thing that this case affirmed is that in Washington State, the committed intimate relationship doctrine applies to both same-sex and opposite-sex unmarried couples. So the courts can divide property fairly in these relationships, just like they can in a divorce.
It's about recognizing that commitment and shared lives can exist outside of marriage.
Right. And that the law needs to protect those relationships, too.
And what's the driving principle behind all of this? Like, why is this important?
It's about preventing unjust enrichment. It's about making sure that when people build a life together, when they share their finances and contribute to acquiring property, they both get a fair share if the relationship ends. It doesn't matter if they were married or not.
So Gormley v. Robertson, it's not just about this one couple. It's about fairness for everyone.
Exactly. And it's a great example of how the law can evolve to keep up with social change. Absolutely. So for our law students listening, what do you think is the key lesson here?
I think Gormley v. Robertson shows them how important it is for the courts to adapt, you know, to really think critically about the law and apply it in a way that reflects the reality of people's lives. It's a reminder that the law is not static. It's constantly evolving.
It's the living thing.
Exactly.
All right. And as we kind of rack things up here, I have a question for you. You know, same-sex marriage is legal now. So what does that mean for the future of the committed intimate relationship doctrine? Like, is it still relevant?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes, it's definitely still relevant. Because even though same-sex couples can get married now, there are still plenty of couples, both same-sex and opposite-sex, who choose not to marry for whatever reason. And this doctrine protects them. It ensures that their contributions are recognized and that things are divided fairly if they split up.
So it's like a safety net in a way.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
So even though Gormley was decided in a very specific context, you know, back when same-sex marriage wasn't legal, its impact is still being felt today.
Absolutely. It's a landmark case, and it continues to shape the way we think about fairness and equity in all kinds of relationships.
Well, thanks for diving deep with us today. I think this was a really illuminating discussion.
My pleasure.
And for everyone listening, keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.
See you then.